welcome to Local Talk Friday on KHOI Community Radio, where we capture the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Paul Wearson.
And I'm Dennis Hart. It's great to be back with you again today, Paul, on this very hot Friday.
Hot and humid, and my uncle used to say it's close outside.
It's close outside?
Yeah, when it was humid, he'd say it's close. It's so close.
It's going to get really close today. Temperatures in the upper 90s and maybe into the hundreds. We're going to have a bit more on that coming up. And we have a heck of a show today, Paul. It's going to be a great show. We have in this half hour a look back at the tornado that ripped through Marshalltown 1 year ago today. And we're going to talk with two people about how that community is recovering.
And then later, Alex Pfeiffer of the Ames Historical Society will be here with a heads up about some new things that are going on in the works. And then old friend Maggie Westfold will join us with one of her unique looks at life in Iowa.
And we can hardly wait for that. But first, right now, the Marshalltown tornado. 1 year ago today, an EF3 twister with winds up to 144 miles an hour roared right through that community 40 miles east of Ames. No one died, but the tornado damaged many buildings downtown, including the historic Marshall County Courthouse. Hundreds of homes were damaged, along with the Lennox Manufacturing Plant and the JBS Pork Processing Plant. Lives were turned upside down. We're going to be talking about that this half hour, and joining us on the phone right now, the managing editor of the Marshalltown Times-Republican newspaper, Emily Barsky. Emily, welcome to Local Talk.
Hi, good morning.
Your newspaper has done hundreds of stories. You told me about 400 stories since that tornado a year ago, many of them about people. How did this tornado impact people in your community? Tell us some of those stories.
Right. Well, one of those first things that I remember, our building was in the impacted area. So when we walked outside, we were right, you know, where the tornado had gone through. And I remember walking down the street, and one of the buildings at the corner of Main Street and Center Street, the top floor had almost completely crumbled off and was in the street. So there were all these bricks blocking the street. And first off, people were kind of in shock and looking around, not knowing what to do. And then we were getting some photos, and I remember maybe, and this was maybe 5-10 minutes after the storm, I turned around, and there were complete strangers simultaneously picking up these bricks, shuffling them to the side, and they were working quietly. They were, none of them were talking, and I doubt maybe a couple of them knew each other, but most of them didn't know each other. They were just there. They were moving those bricks, and that was the first thing that I saw that said, you know, people are going to work toward recovery together, and they're going to do it in the humbled way.
Well, Emily, I think that one other feature about the immediate aftermath was the turnout of people outside the community who came to help. I know that a lot of folks just came to Marshalltown to pitch in.
Right. There were people from all over that came to help. I know that the mayor has talked about when he got to the fire station, which was where they were kind of making command central because there were so many other city buildings that were damaged. When he got there, the first people he saw were the Parkersburg crew. So that was pretty impactful. I know that from the first responder standpoint, there were people from all over. I think even I think one of the farthest was Iowa City, which is almost 2 hours away from here, that showed up that night. So there was just, I think at one point there was 40 different ambulances lined up from across the state that night trying to help anyone who had any kind of injury.
Emily, there had to be a sense of shock that went through the community after this tornado on that afternoon. People had to be stunned in many ways, including you folks at the Times-Republican. Tell us in the immediate aftermath, how did you organize to start covering this thing? Because you were affected as everybody else was. What did you folks do?
Right. Well, we walked out of the basement and just first it was just my publisher and I, and we looked around and we thought, wow, this is pretty big. This isn't, you know, just a little bit of wind damage. This is a pretty big deal. We had one reporter that was there in the basement, and then other staff members. But for the news team, that's who was there. We had another reporter that was already out of town because he was going to be covering something there, and he had he actually had internet at the time. None of us had internet anymore, or and very very spotty cell reception. And then another reporter was seeking shelter in his house, which was also in the impacted area. So we kind of just got out there immediately and got some photos and things like that. And then about an hour or so after the storm, we met up outside the TR, and I'm not even sure how we were able to get a hold of everyone. Now I know my phone wasn't working. We would have had to use someone else's, but we all met there and decided we're going to team up and just go out and talk to as many people as we can and try and, for this first night, we're just going to see how much impact there was, get as many people's stories as we can, and then everyone would send it to me as I was out of, as we got out of town where we had internet, and then I'd compile it all together. So it was just kind of a team effort. Everybody go get something and then get it to me.
Now, when you look back, Emily, is there one particular story that stands out in your memory, a personal story from somebody you encountered?
Yeah. One of the stories that we told maybe a couple days after the tornado, there was an older woman who rode out the tornado in her living room, and she was home alone, and she wasn't able to get downstairs herself, so she sat in the living room. The whole roof came off. Things were collapsing around her, and next to her, you know, things, and you see these photos, and there's, I mean, the fridge is in the middle of the kitchen. There's just debris everywhere, but she was completely unharmed, unscratched, and sitting next to her, and I can't remember the exact words, but it was something like there was a little pillow or something that said, you know, an angel's watching over you. And that one really got to me and stuck out to me, because there was a lot of devastation. There's a lot that has to happen, but thank God no lives were lost.
Right. That was an amazing thing. Hundreds of homes were damaged. You know this better than we do. How did the community, how did those neighborhoods respond in the immediate aftermath and since? Has there been a sense of community coming together in those neighborhoods to bring Marshalltown back?
Absolutely. The one of the neighborhoods that was hardest hit in the northern quadrant of town, it's also a low-income portion of the city, and a lot of them were uninsured or underinsured, and so that was a big push to get help there. So there's a lot of people that went to those neighborhoods, and really just anywhere a lot of people went to help. But I know there, particularly people that were getting help, they, you know, they're getting help from complete strangers a lot of times, and, you know, they wanted to give back to them in some way. I heard a story of someone, they were working on a home, and then the family walked out. They had a whole rotisserie chicken for the people that were helping, and
wow.
That's just, you know, one example. I mean, people were helping other people, and the people that were getting help were trying to do anything they could. So it was pretty awesome to see.
Fantastic. You know, a central event like this will be remembered by everybody. I used to sub for a pastor up in Belmont, Iowa, and back in 1968 they had a tornado that hit the downtown that totally destroyed downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about that event to people, everyone has a tornado story. And so even years later, that's the central event. That's the 9/11 for them. That's the Kennedy assassination for them. That is the central event by which they mark before and after. And, Emily, I think that's probably the way it is for the folks in Marshalltown. Life before the tornado, life after the tornado.
What's your sense of that, Emily? Is the town, I don't want to say better. It's never better after something like this happens. How has it changed?
There is definitely a renewed sense of community pride. Marshalltown has always been, you know, a city where people are proud to be from Marshalltown, and they'll tell people that. But it's just been, you know, Marshalltown Strong has been the theme. And everybody has stuck to that in some way or another. And whether that's in offering their help or finding or beyond tornado with some of the other tragedies that have happened in town in this past year, people have found ways to come together. And so I think because of the storm, there's just been even greater community pride and a lot of people saying, well, you know, we might have a difference in opinion on this or how this should be done, but we'll set that aside.
Well, Emily, on this day, the anniversary date, I know there's a lot of activity from the media that's going to be happening in Marshalltown, and I think your paper is putting together a commemorative issue. You might talk about that.
Right. So we put together a four-page section. Some of it is our regular news content, but the majority of it is tornado anniversary content. And today, the newspaper carriers are still out. They started at midnight, but it's getting delivered to every household in Marshalltown, regardless of if they're a subscriber. So we're just doing that as a public service because we believe it's, you know, as you said, this had a profound impact on the town. People are pre-tornado and post-tornado, and we want to make sure that everyone gets to have a copy.
That's the great thing about print media.
Yep.
People can keep this forever.
Yes.
And what a nice thing that it's going to everybody, regardless of whether they're subscribers.
Exactly.
That is a community service, and a lot of people are going to cherish that. It's going to end up among the personal effects of a lot of people, and that's going to be passed on to the next generation.
Now, Emily, I understand you also, your newspaper is sponsoring, putting together tonight, a fundraiser that's a very big deal at Marshalltown Community College. Please talk about that.
Yes. We're hosting our Progress and Pride banquet tonight at the college. We're having Governor Kim Reynolds come there, and she's going to kick it off and open up the program. And then we're going to have some local speakers talking as well. But it's kind of a typical banquet, and then the program, and it's everyone who purchased the ticket. Those ticket sales are all going to rebuild Marshalltown, which is focused on long-term recovery.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be other opportunities for people to donate. And the thing that I'm most excited about is we're doing our Salute Hometown Heroes Awards. And that'll be the very last thing that we do. But we're recognizing five recipients who were nominated by the public. And then a committee of volunteers helped select them. And they just helped Marshalltown in very, very unique ways. And none of them know they're winning it. So it's going to be pretty exciting.
Well, it's going to be a surprise.
Yes.
Wow.
Nice.
That's exciting.
Well, Emily, we want to thank you so much for being with us today on this Friday. I know it's a busy day for you, a very emotional day in the community, and we wish you nothing but the very best, you and your newspaper and, of course, the community in recovering from this. And we just wish you the best on this, and we hope all good things are coming your way.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Emily.
You bet. Thanks for joining us. Emily Barsky, the managing editor of the Marshalltown Times-Republican, an Iowa State University graduate, we are very proud to say. It is 13 and a half minutes after the hour on this Friday, and we will be right back with Mayor Joel Greer of Marshalltown after this musical interlude.
Welcome back to Local Talk Friday. Joining us by phone from Marshalltown now is Mayor Joel Greer. Mayor, thank you for being with us on this anniversary of the tornado that caused so much damage in your city. And now from your perspective, how is Marshalltown's recovery going?
marvelously well.
I'm glad to hear that. Now,
talk about that, Mayor. Dennis Hart here.
Well, I'm thinking that there are two things. There are really two components here.
Yep.
There's the municipal activity and the private homeowner activity. First of all, what's happening? I know the cupola at the courthouse is being worked on. What sort of things are happening from the municipal standpoint, the town of Marshalltown that you represent as mayor?
Yeah, it's almost like we knew this was coming because we had a bond issue that passed and we're building a new combined fire and police building. And the workers that were working on that building when the tornado hit had about the best view of watching the tornado, which hit both our old fire department building and our police station building. And so we had damage to the old buildings that we knew we had to replace anyway, and the new building wasn't, there was no scratch on it from the tornado. And we're about ready to move in, we'll be moving into the new building next month. In terms of the other city buildings, one of them is coming down where the senior center was, that was hit hard enough that it has to come down. It needed to come down anyway. It was costing us too much money, and the seniors have moved to a better spot than that building anyway. And we were pretty well insured, so there really wasn't much impact to city buildings. So the FEMA grant for the public buildings didn't amount to much because we were pretty well insured.
What about the other buildings downtown? I know that many private businesses, restaurants, and other places were damaged by this. How's the recovery for them going?
Well, if you were to drive to town today, you'd see a brand new True Value hardware store that is gorgeous compared to the old dilapidated building they were in before. Where that building was is down to the ground now, but I know people are interested in building something new where that one was. The McGregor store, it's our flagship store for the McGregor's furniture in the whole state, and it's still being worked on. They had to take the top floor off of it, but you can tell it's getting ready to open soon and will be nice. And in the meanwhile, they're selling furniture out at the mall and still in business. Next to it is the antique store. It's open for business. On the other side is the bike shop. They took the opportunity to take a wall out and double their space, redecorate, and they're selling more bikes now than they did ever pre-tornado. And then the restaurants, that's the fun part. Ocean City, while they were closed, is my favorite Asian restaurant here. They tripled their menu, and we now have sushi here, so we don't have to drive to Ames or Des Moines to get our sushi fix.
You know, actually, there's an old term from the 60s, urban renewal.
Yes.
Remember urban renewal?
Yes.
In a way, this has been urban renewal for you, particularly when some of these buildings that had probably lived their lives already were the ones that got knocked down to put in new things. And then it probably motivated a lot of local downtown business people to take the opportunity to remodel and reconfigure their own business, like you talked about. That's great. Fantastic.
What's funny is that this, in the 60s, it was popular to put up new facades, the modern facades.
Right.
Let's cover up the old ones. And so three of the buildings that have had damage to their new facades are going back to the old ones, which fit in better with our historic downtown district, including Ocean City. It had been a bank with these beautiful marble columns. And they put up this ugly, in my opinion, sorry, ugly new modern facade that just didn't fit. And they're going back to the old look, which will just be prettier.
What about your courthouse, that lovely courthouse built in 1886? We all remember the pictures on television from last year of that top, that clock tower coming down. How's the rebuilding going on that?
Slowly. I think it's going to be March before they open. My wife is actually going to get a fifth floor corner office up there since she's on the Court of Appeals now. And it is the prettiest courthouse in the state of Iowa. I've been to like 60 of them as a trial lawyer that handles jury trials around the state. There are 100 of them because Lee County somehow gets two. I don't know why. But it will be the prettiest from the outside. But on the inside, It's going to be state-of-the-art. It'll be almost like a federal courthouse. The federal courthouses are so well-equipped for doing jury trials, having the visual aids and computers to hook in and that kind of thing.
So the courthouse is going to be on schedule. I know it. I saw on TV it's all enclosed with scaffolding, and it looks like they're very serious about that. And all the people working on that project are doing something I could never do. I can't stand height, Dennis. I would not work out on that project.
Yeah, yeah. Mayor, what about the homes? You had hundreds of homes damaged by this thing last year in various neighborhoods. How's the rebuilding on those going?
Well, God bless the Habitat for Humanity. I mean, those folks, they've got like 5 or 6 trucks in town and all sorts of young people with the skill set to help rebuild repair 100 of the homes here. And so the rebuild is going well. It's kind of like downtown. In my neighborhood, which was hit, you know, our home was lucky, but on our block we had a tree come through into a house's kitchen. I can, within two blocks of driving, I will see 3 or 4 houses that have brand new exteriors, brand new siding, way prettier than they were pre-tornado. And so the houses that are being able to be repaired and re-roofed are looking way better than they did. And fortunately, they were insured. In the part of town where there wasn't as much insurance, there are going to be more green spaces of houses that have to come down. But next to them, the houses that are being repaired are going to look better. They are looking better already. And so I don't think the green spaces will hurt the looks of the neighborhood much. Although we are missing housing. We need more housing here.
I bet everyone is planting trees, right, Mayor? A lot of trees were taken out, I'll bet.
That's the saddest thing, to drive around on State Street especially. But there's a high school class that has already raised about $50,000 to replant trees. And that should be done, if not this summer, next summer. And I know Trees Forever is helping out. Earl Mays has helped on a grant. And it will take a while. You know, we won't have those really pretty canopied streets on State Street and Main Street like we had a year and a half ago. But in 20 years, we will. And it'll be planted and with the right variety of trees and making sure that we don't have a Dutch elder's disease that wipes out a whole block when we replant them. There are still a lot of stumps and root balls that are ugly, and the city's been working on systematically taking those out and improving the looks. So it'll take a while, but it'll look good in years.
Talking to Mayor Joel Greer of Marshalltown on this, the anniversary of the tornado that ripped through the community. Mayor, the tornado also hit 2 major plants in your community, Lennox, the manufacturing plant, and JBS Pork Processing. Together, they employ thousands of people, and I know there were some serious concerns after that tornado, but there's been good news in terms of their decision-making after that. So talk about that, please.
Yeah, great news. That was our 2 biggest worries. JBS, the biggest worry there was we have the largest cooling facility in the country, and it had so much frozen pork product in it, and it lost the east wall, and so we just had to figure out a way to get rid of all of the pork product in there in order to get the plant back up in operation. And I think there were 240 semi-loads of pork that had to go. So we opened up a cell at our landfill. Des Moines Metro was very kind to let us offload a lot of things down there. And then there was a pet food company in South Iowa that actually bought a lot of the product that they could use. So we got that plant back up in about 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
Lennox was the bigger concern.
It was really they hit. Lost. I was there, and that place was really hit. Talk about that.
Yeah. How nobody died in the Lennox plant, I don't know. Everybody got to the right restrooms and safe areas, and no even serious injuries happened. They're back up to 800 to 850 employees. I talked to the HR director yesterday. I was amazed they had that many people back, because pre-tornado it was about 800 was the number of employees I've been telling people work there. And so they're back in full swing. Well, not full swing, but they've got a lot of employees back and working. The fear was that they would close the plant,
right.
And the plant manager had just opened a plant in Mexico before coming up here, Miguel Gutierrez, and it would have been easy to say, well, let's just go fully populate that plant in Mexico, and I'm pretty sure Miguel was the one that went to the higher-ups at the company in Texas and said, no, we make the best product here, we have so many good employees here, we have to rebuild, and the president was kind enough to schedule an appointment with the governor and lieutenant governor at 3:30 on the Monday after the Thursday tornado, and an appointment with me at 4:30, knowing that at 5:30 I had a city council meeting to run. And they said they wanted the mayor to be the one to announce to the town they were staying.
Wow.
That was pretty cool for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously they felt comfortable in the community. And at the corporate level, they wanted to continue to be vested in Marshalltown. So that says a lot about the people of Marshalltown, you, the leadership of the community, and the amenities they offer to those corporations. I remember particularly the video of all the cars in the parking lots of these industries piled upon each other.
Yep.
And I just thought, how would you like to be a claims adjuster on that project? I wonder what the total is on just auto damage, cars that were lost during that tornado. And it really did impress me, always is, with cars. That shows you the force of a tornado, that it can move a car like that, pile them up. And that even makes it more remarkable that there weren't a lot of death and injuries. Because I remember a tornado in Belmond back in 68. They had 6 killed up there. And so that's really marvelous. And, of course, the Parkersburg tornado, there were deaths there. So we're very, very fortunate that
Absolutely.
There were no deaths.
Mayor, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, how would you sum up what's happened in Marshalltown since that terrible day a year ago?
We have a city that has good leadership in just about every leadership role. You know, our city administrator is wonderful, police chief, fire chief, school superintendent, the commandant at the veterans home, and the plant managers of every plant that we have that are now up and running and in full capacity. And that's critical if you're going to get hit with a tornado like this. But after the tornado, we had a coalescence. We were already collaborating well, but now we got to know each other even better. And there's been kind of a fun spirit to watch in the city to repair things and make things better than they were in the first place. So I know I sound like a cheerleader. I am a cheerleader. This town is a great place to live and work and play, and it's going to be better because of the tornado.
Well, Mayor Joel Greer, terrific to have you here with us. And, you know, your stories and what we heard from the managing editor of the paper in town just really is remarkable in terms of how everyone rose up in the face of adversity. And whenever I hear about something like that, the sort of the phoenix rising from the ashes, and not only immediately in the aftermath, but continuing for a whole year, has been this marvelous rejuvenation of the community. And all the people who reacted positively, favorably, and effectively to make Marshalltown survive this thing. People rose up. I'm reminded of that inscription on the Marine Corps Monument in Washington, D.C. Uncommon valor was a common virtue. Thank you, Joel Greer, Mayor of Marshalltown.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
That's good stuff, Paul. Marshalltown's recovering 1 year later. They had a very tough time, but it appears as if things are on track, and maybe, just maybe, it's going to be a stronger, closer-knit community, better in many ways.
Well, I hope that everyone there today can take a bow. They deserve to take a bow.
You bet. It is 30 minutes past the hour. This is Local Talk Friday. I'm Dennis Hart. He's Paul Wearson. Now let's take a quick look at what made news around Ames this past week from the pages of the Ames Tribune. On Saturday, the Trib reported that the Story County Sheriff's Office had issued a warning about a telephone scam making the rounds in which someone who says they're from the Sheriff's Office, but they're not, calls and asks for payment to resolve an outstanding warrant. Caller uses the name of a real deputy and pressures people to make payment. Sheriff's Office never does that, so if you get a call like that, just hang up. Sunday brought word the Democratic presidential hopeful Amy Klobuchar had come to Ames on Saturday to help raise money for Iowa House District 46 Democratic nominee Ross Wilburn. Also Sunday, a report on Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst's visit to Ames. She talked about the issue of human trafficking in Iowa, saying the federal government has passed a number of bills that deal with it. Sunday also brought a report about Friday night's Lights to Liberty event in Nevada, a candlelight vigil designed to shine a light on conditions at immigrant detention centers on the Mexican border. And there was a story about Ames mom Rebecca Finch's successful fundraising effort to purchase a so-called cuddle cot for Mary Greeley Medical Center. A cuddle cot is a cooled bassinet that slows natural changes that take place after death. It would give families who experience stillbirth or infant loss more time with their babies. One of Rebecca Finch's daughters was stillborn. On Tuesday, word that gas service had been shut down to part of the Northcrest Community Senior Living Complex in Ames because of a leak near the Hartwood House on that campus. No gas went into any of the units. No one was evacuated. Also a report that Auburn University was paying former Iowa State University president Stephen Leith $4.5 million to leave. Leith was at Auburn 2 years, and the payout is more than he would have earned had he stayed on the job under the original terms of his contract. He went to Auburn after leaving Iowa State in 2017. Also word that Iowa 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King would be appearing this morning in Ames at the city auditorium, and that Democratic presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders would make a campaign stop in Nevada tomorrow night at the State Farmers Union summer picnic. Wednesday brought word that authorities found the pickup truck used in a bank robbery in Ames earlier this month. The three suspects are still on the loose, but their pickup was found in a parking lot. Also word that Iowa State University had received $469 million in external funds during the 2019 budget year. That allowed a record $260 million to be used for research. Yesterday brought word about this week's Ames City Council meeting, where council members heard about the city's so-called 2040 comprehensive plan. The goal of that plan is to project how the city could accommodate the estimated increase of 15,000 more residents over the next 20 years. Several potential growth areas have been identified in various parts of the city. Also yesterday, a story about the new principal of Fellows Elementary in Ames. Lana LaSalle has been a principal in the Bettendorf School District, and she's worked in education for more than 30 years. Also report on the upcoming Rummage Rampage in Ames, an 8-day event that will start next Friday. It's a way for people who are moving to get rid of items they no longer want without leaving them on a curb and having those items eventually wind up in a landfill. One more note from yesterday, a report on the coming weekends, this weekend, Summer Iowa Games in Ames. More than 10,000 athletes expected to take part, competing in 47 events, everything ranging from archery to tennis to soccer to disc golf. Today's paper had word about that heat wave we're going through, and it's an important read. Temperatures are expected to reach the upper 90s to near 100 today. An excessive heat warning is in effect until 7 tomorrow night. Health experts say we all need to drink a lot of water and stay out of the sun. Ames has two cooling centers, the North Grand Mall and the library. Use them if you need to. And keep your animals safe. Make sure they have plenty of water and do not leave them in cars. Also today, word the Democratic presidential hopeful Tulsi Gabbard going to show up in Ames tonight for a meet and greet at Cafe Diem, 7 o'clock. Also a report that early voting has started for the August 6th special election to fill the Iowa House District 46 seat, left vacant when Democrat Lisa Heddens was appointed to the Story County Board of Supervisors. And a story about a new program in the city of Ames that lets participants turn their food scraps into nutrient-rich additives for gardens through a new pay-as-you-go compost option. It's called Food Waste Diversion. We've talked about it here on Local Talk. You can read all about it in today's paper. And that is your summary of the week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune. We're going to take a short break now, but do not go away because we are going to be right back here on Local Talk.
Well, welcome to Local Talk Friday. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us. I'm Paul Wearson, along with Dennis Hart. Coming up later this half hour, Maggie Westfold with a look at life in and around Ames.
But first, we are pleased to welcome back another one of our favorites, one of our all-time favorites, Alex Pfeiffer from the Ames Historical Society right next door here to us on Douglas Avenue. Welcome back on this Friday, Alex.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me today.
Are you going to stay cool today? It's going to be a terribly hot day.
Oh, you know what I do? Whenever I'm beating the heat over there, I just go take my 15-minute break in our 62-degree archives room at the Historical Society usually.
62 degrees?
62 degrees all year round.
Can we get a key? We want to be there later today.
I'll help you with the archives all day.
You'll have to schedule a tour to get back to there, I believe.
So. Hey, what do you got going over there? You've got an exhibit going on. It's been going on for a few weeks now, and
I've seen it.
Construction, right? Construction around Ames.
Yeah, well, it's focused around the Farwell Brown Photo Archive. Farwell Brown is our Historical Society founder, one of our founders back in the 80s, but certainly one of our greatest faces, city historian Farwell Brown. And so we took a good collection of 50 of some 2,000 or so photos that he had in his collection, kind of dealing with a certain view or location in Ames that is not something you could see today. So you go and you look at a thing like the Grand Avenue Underpass is a favorite, something I literally go under every day on my way to work.
Yep.
But maybe you've never seen it in 1981 when they had a train derailment and a car was knocked all the way from the railroad bridge down to the actual underpass part. So it's about kind of showing you your local environment that you're used to, you see every day, you're there every week. But you've never seen it like this. So it's kind of a unique view of Ames that we're trying to portray to people.
I actually have a story about that train derailment, Paul and Alex. I was here teaching journalism at Iowa State on that Sunday morning. It was a Sunday. And I heard that the train had gone down. So I rushed over. We were living near the Roosevelt Elementary School. And sure enough, there were cars on the bottom on Grand Avenue. So I took I don't think I took pictures. We didn't have cell phones back then. Maybe I had a camera of some kind. But I immediately did a report for the Iowa Radio Network because we had a connection at Iowa State University. And so we put out the word from that. That was a heck of a story. That doesn't happen. It's happened, but not very often.
Not very often. No, not in our more recent history names. There was a couple that happened in the late 70s. And maybe if you guys remember those two, I think in like 78 there was one. But not nearly as bad as this one in 81 that actually physically knocked the car down. There was a couple that kind of just accordioned behind Main Street, but never made it anywhere near the Grand Avenue underpass. So it was an issue they were dealing with in the late 70s, early 80s, and I think they finally got up on their track maintenance and were able to solve that issue.
Yeah, well, I saw the picture of that in the Tribune, and I commend you or the Tribune for almost every week they publish some historical photo.
Yes, yes.
That takes us back.
Yes.
You know, the clothing.
Yes.
And now I'm old enough to know that, we did wear those. terrible time.
That's one of my jobs over there, too. I write the weekly captions for those photos and pick those out. So we try to do it somewhat topical. Like if you'll tune in this Sunday, you'll see a photo of Ragbri tents at Iowa State Center with Ragbri starting this week. Or, you know, sometimes I simply just say, hey, let's go look up July 28th, 1975, and see what was in the paper that day and see if there's anything, you know, because sometimes there's those fun little one-off stories that aren't it's not anything national, it's not or anything big. We're not going to keep revisiting this every year, but just fun little things. I think I put a picture of they had a baby rhino at ISU that was from the Henry Dorley Zoo that needed to come and use, I think it was either our CAT scanner or MRI machine here because of the ones we use for cattle. And so we had a picture of, I believe his name was Tiny, and kids sent little get well cards to him and stuff like that. You know, just those fun little one-off stories that people that are in the community remember. But it's not, a huge, massive story that we're going to go write a book about or anything like that. But it's a fun way to interject these little daily
things.
Well, people
need to know how things used to look. Like, I'm thinking of the old football stadium.
Oh, Clyde Williams.
There is no trace of that.
There is absolutely not.
You would not know there ever was one.
Yes.
Mm-mm. And how valuable all the pictorials you have concerning that are to understand for the younger people that, hey, there was a football stadium where all these street intersections now are.
Exactly,
houses.
It's hard, very hard to imagine. That was one thing that I learned. Obviously, I was an Iowa State student and then learned a lot of the more of the history of some of the that part of the university later on. So, yeah, you think that. You're like, how did that ever work? And my other thought is, where did everyone park? Yeah,
that was true. And the other thing is, growing up in the area in Story City, our place to come as teenagers was Ames.
Oh, yeah.
And Ames ended at the El Rancho Drive-In Theater at the West End. And, of course, there's been all this building and development since then. And when you're older, like myself, you think, look what's happened in my lifetime in Ames, Iowa.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of this documentation came from, as you just mentioned, Alex, the Farwell T. Brown collection. We want to talk about that. Farwell Tilden Brown, a scion, if you will, of the great Tilden family that founded the Tilden store that was here for 100 years, and the father and their sons became mayors of this community. And the Brown family, Harry Brown, Farwell's father, Farwell T. Brown took thousands of pictures, which were on your website.
Yes, we linked to them.
And now they've moved over to the library's website. So, and talk about the difference there, because there is a difference in the look, as you and I have talked about.
Yeah, actually, if you've ever explored Farwell's photographic archive, they actually have the APL, Ames Public Library, has recently done a little bit of a facelift on their whole website, and they included the Farwell site on that because it was still in its functional but very 1990s looking style. Nothing wrong with that. It worked. But so they've updated that. But these are photos that he collected from. He started with his family scrapbooks, like you said. He's from two pioneer families that moved to Ames in the 1860s, just years after it was founded. So he had some great source material with just his family, and he kind of became the repository for all that from his mother's side and his father's side. And then people just started to contact him once they knew that he was collecting, going through and documenting photos. Then other people in the community who had these same stories, same kind of family scrapbooks or same one or two pictures of, you know, the Briley grocery store, that kind of thing. They all just kind of started coming to him, and he was able to formulate all these, make copies of them using old camera stands. You know, this is before the days of scanners and things like that. So basically he'd be just taking a new picture of that picture. So we have all those negatives actually stored at the Historical Society and the prints from that. So we kind of have custody of that. APL actually owns the negatives and the photos. That's why they're on their website. Primarily because back when Farwell donated those, we did not have an Ames History Museum. We were just basically – it was Farwell's kind of a one-man show, lots of volunteers, but he just kind of had a little office over at the library. So he donated to them. But right now we actually have custody. So if people ever are looking to use those for books and things like that, they come through the Historical Society here. The library points us at them. But what a great resource. They go all the way back to some of them back to the 1860s when the town was just founded, and primarily up until about the 1930s. Farwell didn't do too much post-World War II research. But there are some images in there. Like we have a few of them in our exhibit, like the train derailment. And if you were around in 1968 when the Collegiate Manufacturing had a huge warehouse fire, that was the old canning factory burned down. Farwell went down and actually snapped that photo himself, and that's one in his collection. So there's a few that are actually taken by Farwell that are in this exhibit, and a few that have come from a variety of sources through the years. You know, he went to the DOT and got a lot of the Ames pictures. Iowa State, ones that had more to deal with downtown, places like that had good collections there. Yeah, so it's a fun little exhibit. And if you haven't seen it yet, you better come in quick because it is going to go down on August 3rd. So we have less than – it'll be Saturday. It'll be 2 weeks tomorrow to come see that exhibit.
And what do you have coming up on August 3rd?
And then we got coming up. It's making me thirsty here. We're doing the history – we're going to do Uncorked, the Spirited History of Alcohol in Ames. So Ames has quite the tales of alcohol in it from – but, you know, some great bookends there are basically the town was founded dry and Visha riots. So you kind of have a good example of the whole spectrum there that this exhibit's talking about. But we're doing this with 2020, January 1st, 2020 is the 100th anniversary of Prohibition taking effect. So we thought this was a great opportunity to talk about the history of alcohol in our town. So we're going to be talking about people like Billy Sunday, who was a known from Ames, national preacher, spoke about Prohibition, but then also Mr. K.W. Brown, Farwell Brown's grandfather, who also toured around Iowa and some places in New York and also spoke about Prohibition. And we have about a dozen or so flyers of his from some of the places he was speaking at, like Rose Hill in Des Moines, that we're going to have plastered up on the wall. So, and a little hidden speakeasy that'll be in there, where you'll be able to find the door and enter our speakeasy and read a bunch of bootlegging stories from the 20s in our bar there. So it's going to be a little bit of everything for everybody, not just 1920s Prohibition. It's covering the entire history of Ames. So, you know, some people are around that remember the old state liquor stores. Paul?
Oh, yes.
Paul Dennis,
yes.
Do you guys ever frequent any of those?
Well, we can't reveal that on the air here. But
Well, you wrote your name in a book.
Yes. It was a permit. It was a permit you had to get. Yeah. It wasn't a right. You had to get the permit there and go in and tell them you want a, what, like a 2848, and you get a nice bottle of Smirnoff vodka there. And
right. That's what it was. And they were little books. And my brother was teaching school in Dubuque. And every weekend there was just the bridge was clogged with people going to Illinois where you could get liquor by the drink at the old Circle Club there.
Yes.
And so Iowa finally realized probably we better change that. So I remember that turnover, too.
Yeah, that was up until 1987, the year I was born.
1987,
they switched off.
I've got couches older than you, Alex. I mean, what can I say? Wow. 32 years old, huh? Hey, give us a hint. Was this a wild and crazy town at
times? Know, it's got, I think more of its wild and craziness comes out in the more recent years. It's definitely a very, with the college being around, a very conservative town. Mm-hmm. A lot of people not wanting, in fact, we talk about the state liquor stores. Give you your little sneak history here on the exhibit, but Ames was the largest city in the state to not have a state liquor store.
Oh.
And the two busiest in the state were Boone and Nevada, if that tells you anything. So.
Is that right?
Another economic opportunity missed.
There you go.
Exactly, exactly.
Wow.
So that's all stuff that's new to me.
Right?
My gosh, that's fantastic.
So this will be some fun stuff, yes.
It's going to be uncorked.
Uncorked. And that's going to open on August 24th. We're actually going to have a little street party in the back of our parking lot, and people can come in and do that. And I think next month we'll talk a little bit more about that. But the day before that, on August 23rd, we're having our annual benefit dinner, and it's going to be speakeasy themed. And by the time I'm here next week, we'll have the event will be closed already for catering numbers. But if you want to join us for our annual benefit dinner, it's going to be up at Prairie Moon Winery, just up northwest of Ames.
Don't mention any costs. We can't do that.
I will not mention any costs. Yeah, if you want to get tickets, you can find them on our website, either on our community calendar, August 23rd. But, if you want to come up, we're going to have a dinner by Tasteful Dinners. We're going to have social raffles. There's going to be dancing, of course, because it's the 1920s speakeasy.
And you're going to have that kind of music, too.
Yes, right? Of course. Yeah, we're going to be playing
a lot of
1920s jazz.
Suit.
There you go. But you've still got one in your closet, don't you? You still have one.
I'm wearing one Sunday.
flapper and dapper. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
You dress up like that. So it's going to be a great time. We'll have we're going to give out some of our annual history awards, like the Farwell T. Award. Just going to go out to Mary Atherley, who was on our board for many, many years. And she used to run the Iowa State Farmhouse. I'm sure everybody's familiar with the farmhouse.
Oh,
we're
also
going to give our Ames History Maker Award, and that's going to go to the Buck family, who Bob Buck Construction, the Buck Dentistry, so the contributions that the Buck family has made to the Ames community. So it's going to be a great time. We encourage people to dress up in 20s outfits if you want.
Wow.
And you can find out more information on AmesHistory.org to get some more of the details and lists of auction items we have if you want to get interested. You know, Iowa State Center tickets, artwork done by local artists Linda Emerson, Stuart Buck, people like that. So it's going to be a lot of fun. We're getting really geared up for Prohibition. It's making us really thirsty over at the Historical Society.
What I'm impressed with is your creativity.
Oh, thank you.
And the ideas and the events you come up with, because it's possible for a Historical Society to be staid and uninventive.
Yes. It can be very easy to just fall into those routines. Yeah.
Now tell me, you've got an army of volunteers.
We do.
Do you need more? Are you always in need of more?
Oh, we're always looking for more people. You know, obviously that we have jobs that are of no skill set at all. If you want to come in.
Which Paul and I can do.
that's our level.
Yes. You know, we can train you to scan pictures. We have over 1 million negatives from the Ames Tribune that we are going to be scanning for years to come and identifying for years to come. So that's a big project. Or if you have a certain skill set, a woodworker, computer engineer, something like that, that you think, hey, maybe my talents could be used for the Historical Society, too. That's also – we love to – We love to use people to their full potential. So whatever they're able to get into and help us, if you're interested, you know, ameshistory.org. We have a contact us page there. You can get a hold of us or call us at down there. And we're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4. So come in and see that Farwell Brown exhibit one last time if you haven't been there. It's really fun. We have some 1800 stereoscope images, which is like 3D aims from 100 years ago. You can go check it out.
Stereoscope at home.
Yeah,
I could bring that.
We have a couple on display. You don't have. You don't necessarily have to bring your own.
Alex, you need to be a regular here just to keep.
You are a regular here, but we got to go right now. We'll see you next month.
Sounds good.
Alex Faefer of the Ames Historical Society. We're going to take a very brief break. Maggie Westbolt in the wings, ready to give us her take on life in and around Ames in just a moment. Hello again. It is 9 minutes to the top of the hour. We are in the home stretch of this edition of Local Talk Friday. And what better person to be in the home stretch with, no, not with Paul Wearson, but Maggie Westbolt.
Well, we call this part of the program Minutes with Maggie, where she tells us what she's been thinking about this past week. And Maggie, it's all yours.
Well, good morning, KHY listeners. And thank you, Dennis and Paul. I'm glad to be back. Today I'm going to share some memories about my favorite aunts and uncles, something I think everybody can relate to. Everybody's got their own favorites, and maybe this will bring up some memories for you. The lady who literally took credit for my very existence was my mom's older sister, my Auntie Perry. Her name was Jenny, but she was always Auntie to us. She brought my mom north from Missouri to visit her Ames home in 1931, and it was on the very first day of that visit that she introduced her younger sister to my dad, a co-worker of her husband. My parents were married later that same year, and Auntie often liked to say, "Just look what I started," referring to the 12 children my folks eventually raised. Auntie was the consummate domestic. She kept a tidy, comfy home in the Ontario area of Ames, had a huge lot filled with gorgeous blooming things, and could cook and bake like no tomorrow. Her pie pans were hexagonal, and we all learned to spot them early on at family gatherings, with our aim being dessert from one of those pie pans. My Aunt Helen Foley was the youngest of my dad's 7 siblings. Helen spent her life in Nevada, living with my grandma, working at Donnelly's, doing clerical work, and also keeping a meticulously clean household. When her eldest and much-loved big bro, Mike, would stop by on Sunday mornings after Mass with Alice and several of the kiddos, her strawberry blonde locks seemed to come to attention, on watch, so to speak, as we kids would move on into the living room and perch on the edge of the couch. We never touched that blue ceramic candy dish, though, until she announced, "You kids can have 1 mint apiece, and you can look at the pictures over there in the secretary, but don't touch the glass." She had a generous, giving heart, however, and many Christmases were much more fun for her big bro's kids because she made it possible for my mom to have some shopping money. I will always remember her for that generosity and for her great laugh. She could be pretty straight-faced and stern, but when something tickled her, she would cross those arms and rear back at her midsection with a raucous laugh that came from deep down. I love the image I've stored of Aunt Helen laughing her socks off. And, of course, I have to talk about Uncle Rance. My mom's older brother and his wife, Aunt Mary, and their 2 sets of twins came to Iowa from Missouri many, many summers while I was growing up. It was Christmas in July, so to speak, when Uncle Rance would arrive and open his trunk to reveal watermelons, root beer, and fireworks. What fun family times we had every 4th of July and the week surrounding. His love for kids radiated in his smile and his dark brown eyes, and Aunt Mary was a fun, fun lady with a memorable giggle. By now, I'm guessing you've had your own memories surface of favorite aunts and uncles. These family members are truly gifts for a lifetime, blessings all, both while they lived and in the wonderful memories they left behind for us.
Well, Maggie, as usual, I'm tearing up.
Yep.
When I got up this morning in my farm, my dad started farming up there in 1930 with horses. Mm. And my uncle, Bert, and the first thing I saw when I looked out the window was a fireplace that he built out of stone back in the 30s.
Wow.
And I still use that fireplace to burn things outside. Mm-hmm. And later he had a stroke and wasn't able to do a lot of things for the second half of his life.
Mm-hmm.
But he had built that before his stroke in 1944. Mm-hmm. And it stands like a monument out there. And he was my favorite uncle for a lot of reasons. And it's just nice to have tangible things.
Yeah.
You know, that remind you of these wonderful people.
Isn't it interesting? Yeah. You're absolutely right, Maggie. You have a favorite. Everybody has a favorite aunt and uncle. My mom had 9 brothers and sisters.
Mm.
But I remember most my Aunt Anne, her sister, her older sister, and my Uncle Al. They always came over to our house in California, and they were the nicest people in the world.
Yeah.
And my Uncle Al would do anything for anybody. He'd help out. You needed help. You need your car fixed. You need something to go on. Come on, I'll help you out on this. A very quiet German-Russian family, right?
Mm.
So very quiet but very strong guy. So Anne and Al were always there for my mom after my dad died. And, I mean, I liked my other aunts and uncles, but you're right. There was a favorite there because of the proximity, because of the connections that we had. And, gosh, you have me thinking about them now, as Paul was thinking about his. We always have favorite aunts and uncles.
I think everybody pretty much does. And it's interesting that Paul – it's your Uncle Bert?
Uncle
See, that
Bert.
Andy Perry's husband was my Uncle Bert.
Is that?
And I used to try to run away when I saw him because he would pinch my cheek. He was a cheek pincher.
Yeah, Burton lost his power of speech in that stroke. And so he talked in sort of an abbreviated way that we all understood. Like he'd say, Paul, good. Go, go, go. Roland, 6 miles. Whiskey, whiskey, whiskey. That meant, let's go to Roland and have a drink.
Yeah.
And I could decode that. You know?
Yeah.
Well, you're thinking about that exhibit that the Historical Society is going to have about speakeasies now. That got you thinking about
this. Right. A little prohibition there.
Yeah.
And Burton was always smiling. In fact, in spite of his handicap, he was always upbeat and always in touch. And if someone was going to get married, he'd go, da, 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 da.
Maggie, it is such a pleasure sharing these minutes with you on these Fridays.
Thank you. It's fun to share them with you and the listeners. It's always fun. So,
well,
I appreciate the time.
Yeah, and thanks for being here, and we'll see you again very soon.
Yes.
All right.
Hope
thanks,
to be
Maggie.
Back.
And stay cool today. It's going to be very hot.
Oh,
okay.
We try.
All right. Well, you have been listening to Local Talk Friday, and it's been quite a show. The mayor of Marshalltown, the managing editor of the Marshalltown Times-Republican, Alex Fafer of the Historical Society, and Maggie Westbold. It's been quite a broadcast. We have been your hosts and privileged to be your hosts. I'm Dennis Hart, and he's Paul Wearson.
Local Talk also airs today at noon and 5 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. And you can hear a recording of this show later today online at khoifm.org, as well as finding links to the guests and information you heard during the program. Also, remember that KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley, the very great Kate Shelley. Local Talk, a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, come on down. We'll train you and join the Local Talk team.
And remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks again for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio. Stay cool.